Radha Kijo, and Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Kijo, Namacharya Shilori Das Thakura Kijo, Prem Shiko Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Raita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Kijo, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopina Shaima Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Kijo, Vrindavan Dhamma Kijo, Mathura Dhamma Kijo, Babaji Mayapur Dhamma Kijo, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Kijo, Gangamai Jumuna Devi Kijo, Bhakti Devi Kijo, Tulsi Maharani Kijo, Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda or Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhujale Sri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namani. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Vacharani. Nirvisesa Sandivani Paskacharani Sutta. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 February 15, 2017, Sydney, Australia. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 16. Lord Parashuram destroys the ruling class, texts 8 and 9. Utastuste kushalino.
Utastuste kushalino.
Nidrapaya ivanjasa.
Nidrapaya ivanjasa.
Kitur vidvam sapo viryan.
Kitur vidvam sapo viryan.
Ramas chakre suridvadam.
Ramas chakre suridvadam.
Please check.
Utastuste kushalino.
Utastuste kushalino.
Utastuhu. Got up immediately. Te. Lord Parasram's mother and brothers. Kushalina. Being happily alive. Nidra apaye. At the end of sound sleep. Eva.
Like.
Anjasa.
Very soon.
Pituhu. Of the father. Vidvan, being aware of, tapaha, austerity, viryam, power, ramaha, Lord Parashurama, chakre, executed, suritvadam, killing of his family members. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter, by the benediction of Jamadagni, Lord Parashurama's mother and brothers immediately came alive and were very happy, as if awakened from sound sleep. Lord Parashuram had killed his relatives in accordance with his father's order because he was fully aware of his father's power, austerity, and learning. So we have a happy ending here. That everybody comes back to life and they forgot the whole incident. And it was just erased from their memory that Jamadagni had ordered them to be killed, that the brothers had refused, that Parasram had killed, and that was all over. They had no recollection. Text 9. My dear King Parikshit, the sons of Kartavir Arjuna, Kartavir Arjuna was the one who had stolen Jamadagni's cow and Parasram had killed, who were defeated by the superior strength of Parasram, never achieved happiness, for they always remembered the killing of their father. So they were maintaining a grudge. This is the opposite of forgiveness. And in the next verses, we'll see that they decide to kill Jamadagni. And because they killed Jamadagni, Parasram kills all of them, and he also destroys the Kshatriyas for 21 generations. So basically, there's no more Kshatriyas on earth, and no more male Kshatriyas. And then the Kshatriya women end up marrying Brahmana men. And they re-establish Kshatriya Varna in that way, with influx of Brahmana mentality. As we've said before, generally when there's an intercaste marriage, the children tend to take after the mother. In almost all instances that we read about in the Shastra, there's marriage of different Varnas. The children, like Vidura. Vidura was the son of Vyasadeva and a servant. And he's mostly identified as the son of a servant rather than as the son of Vyasadeva. So anyway, that was how the Kshatriya race was destroyed and then re-established by Parasram. And he did this because the sons of Kartavir Arjuna killed Jamadagni. But he was using this mostly, as we'll see in the upcoming verses, which I'm not going to be reading. He did this mostly as an excuse because these Kshatriyas had disrespected Brahminical culture. They weren't ruling properly. Well, they killed my father, therefore. That was his reason. Okay, purport. Jamadagni was certainly very powerful due to his austerities. He was so powerful that he could do what? Bring people back to life and change their memories. That's pretty powerful. But because of a slight offense by his poor wife Renuka, he ordered that she be killed. This certainly was a sinful act. So who committed the greater sin, Renuka or Jamadagni? Jamadagni, she committed a slight offense. She didn't actually do anything. She was just thinking about it. But he wanted her killed. And as we said, not only wanted her killed by her children. So Prabhupada says this was a sinful act. Therefore, Jamadagni was killed by the sons of Kirtava Arjuna as described here. So even though she was brought back to life with no memory of it and so forth, he had to die for wanting his wife to be killed. And he had to die by being killed. He had to be murdered by Kshatriyas. It was a heavy reaction. Of course, by being killed in that way, his sinful reaction was eradicated, and therefore he was later to go on to become a great sage. He didn't have to suffer in another life. So the idea is that if the government punishes somebody, then that punishment is your karmic reaction. And you don't have to suffer in the next life because the government is representative of God. So by the sons of Kartavir Arjuna, who had been the emperor, by them punishing Jamadagni, and his sinful reaction was eliminated. Lord Parasram, going on with the purport, Lord Parasram was also infected by sin because of killing Kartavir Arjuna, although this was not very offensive. So because he killed the emperor for taking their cow, that was also sinful, although it was not very offensive because Kartavir Arjuna had stolen their cow. Now, why was that also sinful? Because the government actually has the right to take your stuff. Everything that we own actually, in one sense, belongs to the government. It's called eminent domain in legal terms. Now, I know in America, in our Constitution, it says the government cannot take your things without paying for them. They can't just take them. But the principle that everything you have ultimately belongs to the government is there. Now, of course, the government is not supposed to take the property of a brahmana at all, even, at all. In any circumstance. But to kill somebody because they take your property. It wasn't commensurate. Do you understand? The punishment didn't fit the crime. It was a similar kind of thing, although much, as Prabhupada says here, it was not very offensive. So Parasuram killing Kartavirya Arjuna for taking their cow was sinful because he was the emperor and because the stealing the cow and killing him were not equal. But Jamadagni's offense was much greater. It was very, very sinful. Because he killed his own wife, had his own wife killed by their child because she was attracted to another man, although she didn't act on it. Okay, going on, therefore, whether one be Kartavirya Arjuna, Lord Parasuram, Jamadagni, or whoever one may be, one should act very cautiously and sagaciously. Otherwise, one must suffer the results of sinful activities. This is a lesson we receive from Vedic literature. So you may be Kartavirya Arjuna. He was a very, very powerful person. He was the emperor. Had done a lot of austerity. He was actually an extraordinary person. I think there's stories of him defeating Ravana. Wasn't an ordinary person at all. Jamadagni was a great sage who was meditating on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In fact, when he was killed, as we'll read about in text 11, Jamadagni was sitting by the side of the fire to perform yajna and was meditating on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It was at that time that he was killed by the sons of Kartavirya Arjuna, which is another reason why that killing of him eradicated his sinful activities. He didn't have to suffer after that. Parasuram actually brought him back to life, brought Jamadagni back to life later, and then Jamadagni became a great sage in another situation. But still, if you're that powerful, or you're Parasuram, who's a Shaktivesh avatar, he's a jiva who's empowered with the Shakti of Krishna, he's considered one of the 10 primary lila avatars of the Lord. Still, if you do something sinful, you have to get a reaction. What to speak of me? You know, like Srila Prabhupada said, that we shouldn't be surprised that we suffer if even these great personalities have to be very careful. Prabhupada says, very cautiously and sagaciously, one should be careful with what one's doing. It's considered the greatest defense against the holy name to think, oh, because I'm a devotee chanting Hare Krishna, therefore I can do sinful things. And I can just nullify it by my greatness. So that's considered the greatest. Of course, sometimes Prabhupada will say other things are the greatest defense. But that's considered the greatest defense, to have this mentality. Because I'm a great person, I can do sinful activities. Now, of course, it's interesting. We talk about how the conditioned soul has four defects. And one of those defects is to make mistakes. And how the liberated souls don't make mistakes. Now, if we look at mistakes in the ordinary sense, we find that liberated souls do indeed make mistakes. And we find that even God makes mistakes in that sense. When Krishna sees Radharani trying to churn an empty pot, she's trying to make butter, but there's nothing in the pot because she's just looking at Krishna, so she forgot to put anything in the pot. And when he sees that, he goes to and starts trying to milk a bull. So Krishna makes mistakes like that. Krishna makes mistakes when he's overwhelmed with love, as do the great devotees, even up to Srimati Radharani. The gopis, when they're going to see Krishna, they put on their clothes wrong. Prabhupada said they dress themselves as if they were young children trying to dress themselves. I think you've been around young children trying to dress themselves. You know, the gopis put their clothes on upside down. Prabhupada said they put the lower part in the upper part and the upper part in the lower part. You know, when I first read that, I thought they're putting shirts on their legs and skirts around their necks. But once you wear a sari has this upper part. Then you figure out, oh, they put that part down. Put it backwards. They were putting belts on their ankles, necklaces on their wrists. They were putting on only one earring. They were just decorating one eye. And you know, if any of you are familiar, you know, any of the women would know, and men, if you had sisters, you would know, that young women don't generally do that. For young women, their physical appearance is very important. traveling with my 15-year-old granddaughter. She got a rash from she had a heat rash from those days when it was really hot. Someone said, well, you could put calamine lotion on your rash. And she said, would it look funny? You know, so a young girl is very, very interested in their appearance. Especially if they're going to go see a boy that they love. If a woman's going to see a boy that she loves, she's going to spend a lot of time and care on making sure that her appearance is very nice. So for the gopis, they're going to see Krishna, and they didn't do that. You know, they were so absorbed in wanting to see Krishna that they were making all these mistakes in their dressing. And Krishna was very pleased with that. He was very pleased that, oh, you love me so much that even the concept of looking beautiful to please me, you've lost your awareness of it. Of course, then it says Yogamaya arranged once the gopis, after he showed up for Rasalila, to have them all dressed nicely. They didn't continue in Rasalila with their belts falling off their feet. That wouldn't be very nice. But the point is that mistakes on that level happen even with liberated persons. In ecstasy of love. And even Krishna gets in an ecstasy of love. If Krishna didn't get in an ecstasy of love, what would be the point? He's a supreme enjoyer. So when we say the liberated persons don't make mistakes, we don't mean that they never try to put their right shoe on their left foot. Prabhupada defines mistakes in the purport to the 18th mantra of Ishopanishad as committing sins accidentally. Now, of course, here he's saying even Lord Parasaram committed a slight offense. But that's not really. That was his mission. It was Lord Parasaram's mission to kill Kartavirya Arjuna and his sons. That's what he came to do. Pritranaya Sadhunam Vinashaya Chidusvitam. That's what a Leela avatar does. A Leela avatar is supposed to destroy the demons and save the devotees. In fact, there's one place in Chaitanya Charitamrita where Gopinath Acharya is talking to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, his brother-in-law. And Gopinath Acharya does not mention Buddha as a Leela avatar, but then Prabhupada, quoting Rupa Goswami, does mention Buddha as a Leela avatar. And the reason why Gopinath Acharya might have considered that Buddha was not a Leela avatar was that he didn't kill demons and save the devotees, which is the functions of a Leela avatar. They need to do at least one of them. So this was Parasaram's, that's what he came to do. And therefore, really, there wasn't any offense at all. He's an incarnation of Krishna, and that's what he came to do. But as to set an example, just like after Balaram killed Rama Harshan Sute, it was a similar thing, that the sages said, you know, you can do whatever you like, and for you there's no sin, but if you don't do some sort of atonement, then people in general will not atone for their sins. And they prescribed something very similar as to what Jamadagni prescribed for Lord Parasaram to travel to the holy places. But liberated souls in God, they never do accidental sins. They never do a sin in anger, as Jamadagni here has done. Right? They just don't do that. Now, a conditioned soul, when we say makes mistakes, we mean doing things that are sinful. We talked about the meaning of sin, yes, the other day. Doing things that are sinful. In other words, doing anything that's not totally in harmony with truth. If you're a liberated soul, you're always in the truth. Tatvadarshina, you're always seeing the truth. You're in the truth. You're living in truth. And therefore, if you're living in truth, you're not going to do anything false, either intentionally or accidentally. So a symptom of a liberated soul is that they will never do anything that's out of accord with truth, even accidentally. That's what we mean by mistake. We don't mean they misquote a verse. That's not what we mean. We're not talking about that kind of mistake. You forget the number of the verse, you mix up verses, you tell the pastime story out of order, put your clothes on upside down. Liberated souls may do those kind of things. But here we are told in general that whoever you may be, even if you say I'm a liberated soul, still one should be very cautious and sagacious. So I want to look particularly at here at Jamadagni, not at the other people mentioned here, not at Kartavi Arjuna or Lord Parasaram, but I want to look particularly at Jamadagni, because this is the focus here, and how he actually misused his power. Again, it turned out right in the end, he was killed while he was meditating on the Lord, although he was murdered for his sin. He was murdered in a... I mean, that would be a nice time way to die, right? You're about to do a yajna and you're meditating on Krishna. We were in the kirtan yesterday at the contemporary men's ashram last night. What an amazing, amazing kirtan. And several times during the kirtan, I thought, if I could die now, my life would be perfect. It was just one of those kirtans where everybody was fully absorbed. It was really a group meditation. You know, whenever, and that doesn't happen all the time in kirtan. But whenever you have a kirtan, when everyone who's in the kirtan, every single person is there to go have a deep meditation, then there's just amazing experience in kirtan. So anyway, to die like that, to die in yajna, meditating on the Lord, is very, very nice. So it's not, you know, these are nuanced again. So Jamadagni had to be murdered because he ordered the murder of his wife. But because he was a great sage and a great devotee and the father of Parasaram, he got to be murdered at a yajna while he's meditating on the Lord. So this way the Lord adjusts everything. So we should keep that in mind. Jamadagni is not an ordinary soul. And even though he actually made a mistake, and Prabhupada said it was certainly a sinful act, it was definitely a mistake, still it was rectified in a way that also benefited him spiritually. So I want to keep that in mind. We're not looking at Jamadagni as some ordinary person, but still Prabhupada says we can take a lesson from this. So in that mood that Prabhupada said we should take a lesson from this for ourselves, even though Jamadagni is not an ordinary person, and far, far above somebody like myself. So I want to look at three different things here with Jamadagni, that he preached forgiveness, but yet he punished for a slight offense, that he prescribed a year of atonement for his son, but he himself didn't take up any atonement, and that although he was a person who was regularly meditating on the Lord and was the father of the Lord, still he had to suffer from sinful reaction. I want to look at those three things. So the first thing is that he preached forgiveness, but he punished for a slight offense. And this is just right out hypocrisy. Just straight out, unadulterated hypocrisy. You've done a slight offense, you should do an atonement. I've done a grievous offense, I don't have to do any atonement. Oh, that was the second one. All right, we'll do the second one first. So that's out and out hypocrisy. He tells his son, you killed Kartavir Arjuna, he was the emperor, you should respect the emperor. Even if the emperor does something wrong, he shouldn't be punished. We are brahmanas because we are forgiven. He's going on and on and on about this. This is wrong, you should travel a whole year of atonement. And then he kills his own wife. The difference, if we were to have like a chart and look at it, you know, Kartavir Arjuna steals a Kamadhenu cow from a brahmana. Parasaram's defending his father and doing what brahmanas are supposed to do. They're supposed to curb down kshatriyas who don't respect brahminical culture. It's actually what they're supposed to do. It's their job. Even ordinary brahmanas are supposed to do it. The brahmanas in King Vena's time killed Vena because he wasn't respecting brahminical culture. So that's part of the job of the brahmanas, to step in like that. Plus he's God coming to do a mission. And yet, Jamadagni said, that's sinful, you have to do an atonement. You shouldn't have done that. And even though you don't really need to atone because you're already God, still you should atone and go to holy places for a year. That's a pretty big atonement. A one year's atonement. So we call this special pleading. Everyone else has to do it, but I don't, because I'm special. You know, then Renuka, what did she do? She didn't bring water on time for the sacrifice. Assuming that she was generally a good wife, if we assume that. So this was a one-off situation. And she had some mental attraction to a Gandharva, which is, again, very understandable. I mean, we have, throughout the Bhagavatam, the male sages get attracted to these Gandharva and Apsara women, yes? It happens all the time. So why is it so astonishing that she got attracted to a Gandharva? I mean, they're attractive. I'm sure the Gandharva was much more attractive than her earthly Brahmana husband. And she saw the Gandharva in a romantic mood where he was sporting with women. So that's not unexpected, right? It's not unexpected. You know, and if we think of this, if we reverse the genders, you know, if some man said to his woman, oh, you know, I'm sorry I was late today, I passed by some beautiful woman and I lost track of time staring at her. Yeah, and I don't think the woman would say, well, you deserve the death penalty. You know, you would understand. You know, you might be a little put off by it, but you'd understand. Well, you know, I'm married to a normal human being. And a normal human being, yes, we're all normal human beings. And we may sometimes feel inappropriate attraction to somebody. It's just life. And to condemn her so strongly when the only result was that she didn't bring the water back on time. And as I keep saying, it wasn't even that he was going to kill her. He was going to kill her through someone else. And the persons he wanted to kill her was their own children, which of course would severely traumatize the children. I mean, it would traumatize the children just to see their mother being killed by their father in front of them. But how much more would traumatize the children that they were the ones who had to kill her? I mean, you know. So that means he's punishing the children also. But for himself, no atonement. For himself, no atonement. For himself, well, you know, I was justified because my wife was mentally unfaithful. And there's something really wrong with that. You know, anyway, we'll look at it all together instead of looking at just with this. Okay, so then it was the atonement. You have to do some atonement. Then there was the preached forgiveness and himself not being forgiven. So he goes on to Parasaram. You should forgive Kartavir Arjuna. Basically, I'm better than you because even though Kartavir Arjuna stole my cow, I was willing to forgive him and not take any action. And you should have forgiven him. We're Brahmanas. Of course, Parasaram is kind of a Brahman Kshatriya. If you read the story of his appearance in the Payasa and everything, it's earlier on in the story. Because Arenuka was a princess. When she married Jamadagni, in order for her to have a Brahman child, he prepared a payasa, something for her to eat, that would have her conceive a very wonderful Brahmin child. No, it wasn't her, it was the before that, generation before that. And the mother, when she saw my son-in-law is going to prepare something for my daughter, she thought, oh, could you prepare something for me too? I'd like to have another child. I'd like to have a Kshatriya child. And so the son-in-law prepared one payasa for a Kshatriya child and one for a Brahmin child. And then the mother-in-law thought, you know, he's going to love his wife better. So whatever he prepared for my daughter will be better than what he prepared for me. So she said to her daughter, let's switch. And yeah, this was a generation before. It was Satyavati who had this situation. So Satyavati gave her mother the other payasa. And when the husband found out about it, he said, you're really foolish here. You've married me because you're a Brahmini, actually, although you were born in a Kshatriya family, and we wanted to have Brahmin children, and your mother's a Kshatriya, she was going to have Kshatriya children, now you're going to have a fierce Kshatriya as your child. And she says, oh, that's not very good. He said, all right, it can be your grandson. So that's Parasaram. the effect can be delayed. So Parasuram, although he's born in a Brahmana family, there was this influence, because usually Brahmanas don't go around with choppers killing people. You know, even the Brahmanas who killed Vena, they did it with mantra. But anyway, Jagmadagni is going on and on and on about how we Brahmanas we're not only forgiving, we have the blessings of the Lord because we're forgiving. And in fact, he uses a term to describe the Brahmanas as like personified forgivers. We are the forgivers. You know, I'm such a Brahmana, I'm willing to forgive someone who stole my magic cow. And then when somebody insults him, directly, when it's his wife who insults him, he's not forgiving at all. He could easily have said, "All right, I know why you're late. You got attracted by Chitraratha, right?" And she'd go, "Yeah." And he'd say, "Well, you know, Chitraratha is not only a Gandharva, but he's the chief Gandharva. I'm just a human. I understand that. He's a lot more attractive than I am." And she'd go, "Well, you know, I really love you. I thought that I'm going to run off with the man. I just had a momentary attraction and I forgot my duties. I'm really sorry." And he would say, "Well, that's okay." Right? You can see that sort of scenario playing out. But he doesn't do that. He goes instant fury. And again, his lack of forgiveness was so much more inappropriate than anything on the Parasuram's side. So both of these things, in prescribing atonement when he's not going to do atonement, and preaching forgiveness when he wasn't able to forgive. And when you look at the circumstances, preaching atonement, prescribing atonement, preaching forgiveness, not following atonement, not being forgiving, when his situation was far less of a problem than what Parasuram was dealing with, and his reaction was far greater. There wasn't even an equal situation. So this was special pleading and hypocrisy in a situation that was grossly unequal. So this is misuse of power. Now, most of us have this problem more or less. There's a really nice statement by a 13th century Christian monk, St. Thomas of Aquin, in a book that he wrote called Imitation of Christ. And he was talking about getting along with other people. He said, you know, anybody can get along with nice, compatible people. The real test of our character is how well we can get along with difficult people. And he said, some people are never at peace. Some people are at peace even in difficulty, and some people are not only at peace, but they give peace to others. And he was speaking about the monks living in the ashram with the other monks. And he said, how often do we really think of others the way we think of ourselves? He said, we want to be free to do whatever we like, but we want everybody else constrained by the rules. We want everyone to excuse our mistakes, but the slight offenses of others infuriate us. So this is a general tendency. I mean, in my travels, I ran into somebody who was really, really critical of some devotees because they were speaking to each other very casually with nicknames instead of calling each other Prabhu. You know, sometimes devotees may have a nickname. Right? So like there's, like even Prabhupada, sometimes he called Garga Muni Garga Money. Shri Kirti, sometimes he'd call him Shruto. So sometimes the devotees speak to each other like that. Like I know my name, Urmila. Sometimes Urmila was the wife of Lakshman. And sometimes he called her Urmi. So sometimes out of affection, we may speak to each other with some sort of nicknames. But in this case, it was juniors calling seniors by nicknames. So she was very upset. How can these juniors speak to these seniors very casually? But even though they were juniors and seniors, they were only like maybe 3 years apart in age and they had grown up together. So she was going on and on and on and on and that, about it. But she had had an affair with a married man. And she was saying that, well, you know, if the juniors call the seniors by nicknames, all of our spiritual culture will be lost. Pretty soon, there won't be any Hare Krishna movement. We'll lose all of our etiquette, and we'll lose our... Everything will collapse. If someone calls someone 3 years older than them by a short name and not their full name in Prabhu. I didn't say anything, but I'm thinking, okay, so you had an affair with a married man, and then you're looking at this other thing about and wanting to condemn these people, she wanted them thrown out of their position, some of them. So this is very common that we do this kind of thing, that we look at the faults of others and we magnify them. We talk about them derisively and we magnify them and we want severe punishment to be given to them. We hold them to a very, very high standard. You should be absolutely forgiving no matter what happens to you. If you do a little thing wrong, you should do great atonement. But for me, I don't have to forgive anybody and I don't have to do any atonement because I'm wonderful. Yes? Now we tend to see that my good qualities are like the ocean. I have oceans of good qualities. And my faults are, you know, like little foam on the water. Who cares for it? But your faults, whoa! Your faults are like a cesspool. And your good quality is a little flower growing at the shore of the cesspool because it's getting fertilized by all the excrement of the cesspool. That's our general tendency. In the fourth canto, with the story of Daksha and Shiva, talked about how we see others. You know, that some people, they'll see others, no matter how many good qualities they are, they see faults that even aren't there. Or there's a mixture of good qualities and faults, but they just see the faults. You know, in other persons, they see good qualities where there aren't any. Or where there's a mixture, they just see the good qualities. Or someone negatively can see that good quality is actually a fault. And someone else will see, well, that fault is actually a good quality. I was talking with some parents here the other day about that with children. That often with children, a person's nature can't be repressed. And so children's nature is that which cannot be repressed. But the children may not know how to use their nature properly, so they may demonstrate their nature in a way that really annoys the parents. And the parents will often criticize their children for the very thing that's a child's nature and the child's strength. Okay, so in my own life, the example that I give in my own life is from the time I was 3, the whole time I lived in my parents' home, I was always criticized for the very thing that's become my whole life and my whole service. So evidently when I was 3 and I went to nursery school, the teachers would complain to my parents that your daughter isn't a very good student because she's always helping the teachers. She wants to be one of the teachers. She's not willing to be the student. And this was repeated to me my whole growing up as a problem that I had to fix. This is really bad that you want to be the teacher. My whole life it was presented to me like that. And it wasn't until I was 24 and I met my god sister Jochen Mai that I figured out, but that's because I am a teacher. You know, my parents should have said, oh, maybe you're naturally a teacher, but maybe we should encourage that. So people see, they see faults in the good quality, you understand? You follow what I'm saying? The teachers and my parents, they saw a fault in what was actually my nature. And some people, they see good quality in the fault. You see a child running around the temple room, and you say, oh, they'll do some wonderful thing for Krishna with all that energy. You understand? Yes. So what we tend to do is we tend to see the good qualities in the faults when it comes to ourselves. And we tend to see the faults and the good qualities when it comes to others. This is how we put ghee on the fire of our ego. And how we justify our unrelenting criticism of others and our unrelenting trying to fix and correct everybody but ourselves. And when somebody wants to fix and correct ourselves, we become very angry and very insulted. How dare you say, I have a problem. But let me tell you about all of your problems. And this is the general, am I correct? This is the general nature of conditioned souls. Even if we don't say it, that's what we're thinking. If somebody brings up our problems, we're thinking, how dare you think that? That is just so not true. I am not like that. You know, we may, for social reasons or whatever, just stand there and take it. But inside, we're thinking, I am special. Now you, on the other hand, you know, we have devotees even. I mean, this is Jamadagni. But we have devotees even who make a career of this, of criticizing other devotees, yes? You all run into these people? If you haven't, you're very lucky. So we have people who've made this, as, you know, to criticize. What do you do? What's your service, Guru? My service is to criticize the devotees. And as we would say, I was growing up, God forbid anybody should criticize them. Then they're going to explode. So I may have a huge fault. I mean, Jesus talked about this too. He said, why do you try to take the speck out of your brother's eye? He says, you hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye. Then you'll be able to see better to take the speck out of your brother's eye. So therefore, Mahaprabhu told us, what did he tell us? Trinadapi Sumichana, Taro Iva Sumichana. Don't look for honor for yourself. Don't look for respect for yourself. But give it to others. And Prabhupada said, be strict with yourself and be lenient with others. You know, what we should watch, we should be thinking, how am I behaving? What am I doing? Instead of always, what are you doing? What are you doing? What is he doing? What is she doing? Now you can say, well, if you have a position of authority, Jamadagni had a position of authority over Parasurama as his father, then it's your duty to correct others. That's true. If you have a wife, you have children, brahmacharis are under your care, you have employees, you have citizens, if you're in a position where you're in charge of somebody, you have to correct them. That's a fact. But one shouldn't correct them without understanding one's own position. You want to tell your subordinates to be forgiving, then you better work on being forgiving. Or else you have to say to your subordinates, listen, I'm not a very forgiving person. I really struggle with this. But I understand that it would be good if we could be forgiving. And so maybe if you can do better than me and be forgiving, it would work out. I recently finished an excellent, excellent book in this regard by a Christian author. It's called Unoffendable. What's the name of the author? Brett something. I can't remember his name. And I mean, it was very Christian-oriented, so if you weren't familiar with the Bible or Christianity, you wouldn't get a lot of the examples that he gives. And I was really only able to find one fault in the book. You know, I hesitate to recommend it to devotees because it was so Christian. His only fault was that he said, only Christianity gives a promise of peace, of inner peace to the worshippers. So I even wrote him and I said, you could argue whether other religions actually give peace to the worshippers, but if you're going to say whether or not other religions promise peace to the worshippers, I said, every religion in the world promises its worshippers inner peace. So this was, but other than that, he was saying that somebody who's actually a Christian should not be able to be offended, which is the Trinadapi verse. That nobody can offend them. They have no claims on life. They have no feeling of deservedness. They have no feeling of superiority. What was interesting was it was a very fun book to read. And part of the reason it was fun is that he didn't present himself as an example, a sterling example of what he was teaching, but rather he presented many of his failures. He didn't say, I'm teaching this because I'm so great and I'm never offended by anyone and I'm the epitome of humility and you should all be like that. In fact, he made the point in one of his chapters that that kind of preaching is counterproductive. If you say, you know, I'm so great, be like me, people are just going to be put off. And he had a very humorous, self-denigrating style of presentation. It was very refreshing. So that's the way, and he's a very famous and popular Christian minister. He has a radio show that literally millions and tens of millions of people listen to regularly. So he's in a position of authority. And if we're in a position of authority, we have to be like that. You know, Rupa Goswami has this verse. I was just reading it this morning, Nectar Devotion. I don't have any sadhana. I don't have any pious activities. I can't meditate on Krishna. And I'm not even born in a good family. I have nothing to about me that's good. But somehow, this was the evidence for Ashwabandha of Bhava. He said, but I'm hoping that you, Gopi Janabalava, you will accept me anyway, and this hope is giving me pain because I'm so unqualified. So here's Rupa Goswami is saying this, and he wrote the manual on bhakti. Okay, he's writing a manual with it. Fourth of it is about sadhana bhakti. And he says, I can't do sadhana. Which, of course, literally, externally, is not true. But his mood is, my sadhana is never good enough. It's never good enough. Therefore, I don't really do sadhana. And from that position, he's saying, here's the sadhana that should be done. Hypocrisy isn't if you say, look, I'm weak, I'm fallen, but I know this is the right thing. That's hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is when this is the right thing and you should do it. And you act like you're also on that platform, but actually not. That's hypocrisy. When you pretend to be something that you're not. When you pretend, yes, I am a forgiving, tolerant brahmana. And you're not. You're easily angered, overreacting, insult-affected person who wants to tell other people to be forgiving and do atonement. So that is hypocrisy. And that kind of behavior, especially by religious leaders, damages people's faith in religion. Why are people not interested in religion and why are they not interested in organized religion? It's mostly because of this kind of stuff. And this was explained, of course, in Manashiksha as the thieves' problem. Somebody who's preaching nicely from verse 4. But they're being pulled around by these thieves of lust, anger, envy, fear, illusion, and so forth. So we can't be like that. You know, if we're not acting fully on the platform that we're preaching, and a pure devotee never feels that they're acting fully on the platform that they're preaching. They never get to a point where I think, I am the perfect epitome of what I am preaching. They never think like that. They think, my Guru Maharaj is the perfect epitome of what I'm preaching. The Acharyas are the perfect epitome of what I'm preaching. And I can preach this simply as their messenger. I'm not preaching this because I am the personification of my preaching. They don't present themselves. You can find Srila Prabhupada presented himself like that. When he was talking about four classes of people, and the reporter said, oh, so you're the first class. He said, no, I'm the fifth because I'm serving fourth class people. So unless and that's just not words. I mean, okay, you can start with words. It's better than nothing. It is actually better than nothing. False humble talk is better than no humble talk. It actually is. Because at least it establishes a goal, an ideal. But unless we actually come to that point that we're preaching an ideal, but when we look at ourselves, we say, I'm a mercy case. Not that you hate yourself, that's a mode of ignorance. Krishna says we should love ourselves. But we love ourselves as a mercy case. We don't love ourselves as I've earned bhakti. Otherwise, you know, that's the real thing that damages our preaching. The real thing that damages our preaching, somebody was asking the other day, you know, should I wear a dhoti? That's not the thing. I mean, that may be relevant in some circumstances. In some, what circumstance should you wear a dhoti? In what circumstance should you wear a business suit? But that's not the real thing for preaching, you understand? The real thing for preaching, getting people to take up Krishna consciousness, is not whether you serve layer cake or glove jamuns. That's not the thing. The thing is, are we hypocrites? How do we present ourselves? What's our mood in preaching? And how do we present each other? You know, are we always criticizing each other for small things and not attending to the big things in ourselves? And this comes down to the last point I wanted to make, that although he was meditating on the Supreme Lord and performing yajna, still he committed a grievous sinful action. And therefore, Prabhupada says, everybody should remain cautious and sagacious. Sagacious is internally cautious. Everyone. Nobody should think, well, now, you know, I've been a devotee for 20 years or 40 years, or I'm feeling ecstatic attachment for Radha Gopinath. Therefore, I don't have to be cautious. One should always be cautious. One should always be, you know, in the beginning, one will be cautious because one doesn't want to get murdered by the sons of Kartavirya Arjuna. But at the end, we should be cautious because we want to make Krishna and Guru happy out of love. We don't want to embarrass them. We don't want Guru and Krishna to look at us and say, oh, what a hypocrite. We're their representatives. You know, if we don't behave properly, it reflects badly on our master. Just like you go to a shop, and if the shopkeeper, the person at the desk, you know, some big store, Target or H&M, one of these big stores, have so many thousands of employees. But if the person at the desk is rude to you, it reflects badly on the company, isn't it? And the company is embarrassed. We were out shopping the other day, and there was a sign in the store, if you have any questions, ask one of our friendly staff. So I turned to the person who was helping us, and I said, do you also have unfriendly staff? I said, how do I know who's the friendly staff and who's the unfriendly staff? And he said, no, we got rid of all the unfriendly staff. Everyone here is friendly. So Krishna, we're working for Krishna. We're working for Srila Prabhupada. We want them to be able to say that. We want to be able to put a sign in the temple. If you have any question, ask one of our friendly devotees. And we don't want to have anybody coming and saying, well, how do I know who are the friendly ones? We want Srila Prabhupada and Krishna to say they're all friendly. They're all humble. They're all free from hypocrisy. No, there's nobody who will judge you and condemn you and instruct you in something that they can't do themselves, and they're not admitting that they can't do themselves. We're not that. There's no one who's going to misuse their power and authority in this way. So ultimately, it should be that motivation. As I say, in the beginning, it may be the motivation that, well, I don't want to suffer a sinful reaction. I better behave properly. So even though I'm chanting Hare Krishna, so that I don't suffer. And in the higher levels of bhakti, it should be, I want to behave properly so that Krishna and Prabhupada are proud of me. That you're saying, yes, you're doing this right. Yes, you're preaching right. Yes, you're contributing to an international society for Krishna consciousness. As Prabhupada said, the six loving exchanges nourish the system. So that should ultimately be our motive. And therefore, we should be sage-like and cautious always. And to think, how can I talk about others? How can I think about others? How can I treat others so that Krishna will be pleased? Better to say to others, well, I can understand why you lost your temper. You just chant Hare Krishna. And for us to say, I have no excuse for losing my temper, and I should do an atonement if I have something wrong. It should be reversed. We should be charitable with others when they're not forgiving, and charitable with others in terms of their necessary atonement. And for ourselves, we should always strive to be forgiving, and if we do something wrong, we should always atone for it. So, thank you very much. With these, all these very heavy verses. Wow. You want to talk in the Bhagavatam about verses about Krishna playing his flute? Talk about those kind of verses, and you get these head chopping off verses. Yes. Oh, nice quote by Bhakti Sananta. Also, don't be deluded by the faults in others, just look within.
What does that mean? Are we supposed to see just the good qualities in others and just look or meditate on the fault of others?
Okay, it depends who the others are. So if the others are not people who you are instructing, not people that you have any authority over, then yes, you should only see their good qualities. Does that mean that you should hang out with thieves and robbers intentionally? No. Because we're also enjoined by Rupa Goswami to discriminate about our association. But you can at least see the fault as a potential good quality. Just like Chintamani said, Bilvamangala Thakur, that was a grievous fault. He was so attached to his girlfriend, yet he was having an illicit relationship with his girlfriend. And he was so attached to his girlfriend that when his father's funeral was going on, he told the priest, please hurry up the funeral, I have something else to attend to. And he went in a storm, and the boats weren't operating in the storm. So he saw a log, and he crossed the river in a log, but actually it was a corpse. And his girlfriend had already gone to bed because she thought, well, he's not going to come in the storm. He couldn't wake her up. The door was locked. He saw a vine, and he's crawling up the side of the building on a vine. He realizes it's a snake. That's a pretty grievous fault, isn't it? Is it? Yes? And he was born in a Brahmin family. But she saw the good quality in the fault. She said, oh, you're so determined. You're willing to sacrifice everything. That's a very good quality. Use it for Krishna. So she saw the possibility of a good quality in the fault. At least we should do that. That's the lowest level of seeing good in others, as explained by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in the Pastime of Doctrine Worship. That's the absolute lowest level. At least we should do that. We may not be able to, you know, we can't imitate the Uttama Adhikari from the, as described in the Bhagavatam 11th Canto, who actually doesn't see any faults in anybody. You know, if we see faults, we see faults. You can't like, I do not actually see this fault. I haven't found things like that to be very effective. But you can see the good quality in the fault. I gave the example of myself. The teacher saw that as a fault. And at one level, it was a fault. That here's this 3-year-old going up to the teacher and saying, you know, I think you should have this child do that. And why are you not doing this? And why don't we engage this child in this thing? And I was telling the teacher how to teach when I was 3 years old. So they thought that was very annoying, and it was. It was a fault. The teacher was my superior, right? I was just a little, tiny kid. But they should have seen the good quality in the fault. You understand? So at least do that. Now, if the fault you see is such that you should not associate with the person, I had somebody write me an email a few months ago, you know, well, I've picked up my chanting again. I'm up to 8 rounds. But I just can't stop smoking marijuana and hashish. So I said, oh, you're looking for cheap instant samadhi. You understand what I'm saying? I saw there was a good quality. You're looking for samadhi, but you're looking for it in some cheap instant way. And he wrote me back, he said, after reading your letter, I was able to give it up completely because I saw it for what it was. And if I had said to him, you rascal deviant, don't think it would have had a good effect. But if somebody's, you know, intoxicated on marijuana, I'm not going to hang out with them as their intimate friend. Does that make sense? Like Prabhupada talked about, he talks about nectar devotion, that everything everyone is doing, they're looking for rasa and they're looking for Krishna. And in one lecture, Prabhupada says people who are murderers are looking for the rasa of horror. And if you want to find that, go to Nisingadev. So I can look at a murderer and say, oh, this person is trying to enjoy the horror rasa. What they're really looking for is the Parasaram Leela. Or the Nisinga Leela. That doesn't mean I'm going to live in their house and let them murder me. You understand? So you see the good in everyone. First of all, most people have some good. I mean, there are people who criticize Prabhupada for seeing good in Hitler. He said, at least Hitler didn't use an atom bomb. And Prabhupada's been so... Prabhupada said, at least Hitler didn't use an atom bomb in World War II. He said, in that respect, he was a gentleman. Prabhupada's been so criticized for this. Oh, you saw some good in Hitler. But you know what? Everybody has some good. And the sadhu sees like that. The sadhu sees everyone has some good.
I just run out of time.
What?
He would nuke us. He ran out of time.
If he had more time, he would have nuked us. But the point is, Prabhupada saw some good in him. He was able to find something that was good. So everybody has something about them that's good. Everyone. And unless they're a liberated soul, everyone has something about them that's bad. So yes, you know, as soon as you see a fault in others, then you can think, this is an improperly used good quality. Because all faults are improperly used good qualities. Every single one. There's no fault. There's no such a thing as evil. It isn't a thing. Evil is just misused good. There's no intrinsic evil. Krishna's energy is Daivyesha. It's a divine energy. The devas of Maya are Vaishnavas. Durga and Shiva, they're Vaishnavas. Lord Shiva is the greatest Vaishnava. We don't have a devil. You understand? Mirinda Supraboot says how our Lord Shiva is the answer to the Christian, Jewish, Muslim idea of the devil. He's in charge of destruction and pain and difficulty. He's dealing with the mode of ignorance. But he's practically Vishnu, and he's a great devotee. You know, they say the devil is like another god, right? It's like there's two gods, one in charge of good and one in charge of evil. But there is no such thing as evil. Evil is misused good. So we see simply someone's fault, it's misused good. And if that could be engaged nicely in the proper way, it would be a good quote. You see like that with others' faults. And with ourselves, I think, I have so many faults, how could I criticize somebody else's faults? If you're in charge of people, if you're an employer, you're a parent, you're a husband, you're a guru, you're a teacher, you must correct others' faults. That's your job. That's your service. But one should never correct others' faults thinking, well, I don't have any. It was Jamadagni's business to correct the faults in his son, Parasaram. But the way he did it was hypocritical. He was prescribing things for his son, forgiveness and atonement, which he himself didn't do. That's wrong. So whatever you prescribe for your subordinates, at least you should be trying to do, and you should be honest about the fact that I'm still trying to do this, that I'm not perfect in it. And you should point out their faults not from the platform of ego and pride, but from the platform of a service. And you point out their faults in such a way that they can turn it to a good quality. You don't point out a fault as just a fault, and therefore you're a bad, evil person. No one is a bad, evil person. Everyone is a soul. It should be not me against you, but me and you against the evil. I'm your friend. I'm your, well, we're talking about guru as friend in Manushiksha. I'm your friend. If ever you have a guru-like position, I'm your friend, I'm your well-wisher, and I want to help you find the good in your fault and turn that thing back to its original position with Krishna. And I'm going to help you with this. And I'm going to help you with this as somebody who themselves struggles with fault. Not as somebody who is a morally superior, not that I'm in a morally superior position, and therefore I can tell you, lowly worm, to improve. Is that all right? Yes.
When you look at all these great sages and you know, they're highly evolved, great devotees, and they're falling down and they've got their faults, etc. And then I get very disheartened about my own inadequacy, you know, all the stuff, and it's all very well to say, well, you know, mercy, but I mean, seriously, I just feel very disheartened.
Okay, well, that's understandable. But look at how Krishna corrects Jamadagni. As I said in the beginning of the class, he got a sinful reaction. He got murdered while he's at a yajna meditating on the Lord. When you're under Krishna's protection, Krishna understands that as long as we're covered by the most material nature and as long as we're in this world, we're going to have a tendency to commit mistakes. We're going to have a tendency. And mistakes means doing sin. We're going to have that tendency. He understands that. That's not an excuse. He understands that. When we do those mistakes, what we can have faith in, I mean, at least I'm sure that I'm going to continue to commit mistakes for a very, very long time. I'm not going to feel encouraged by the idea that, oh, you know, probably tomorrow at 4:32 p.m., I will permanently stop doing things that I feel ashamed of. I'll never have to apologize again after tomorrow at 4:32 a.m. or p.m. when I become a pure devotee. You know, that can't be the source of my enlightenment. That's not going to make it. But the source of our enlightenment is, although I am fallen, although I commit mistakes, although no matter how much I progress in spiritual life, I will probably always fall short of the mark, at least while I'm in this body, in this world. Krishna is very kind. And even if I do something horrendous, because really, what Jamadagni did here was horrendous. I really doubt that any of us will do anything at that magnitude of sinful mistake in this life. That's very unlikely. So if he's doing something at that magnitude, Krishna arranged, okay, you need to get a reaction for this, but it's going to be beautiful. As I said, who wouldn't want to die at a yajna meditating on the... Isn't that where we all want to die? Right? If we're going to plan out our death, a yajna while I'm meditating on the Lord. So he got that. Or Indra, you know, Indra who really messed up, and Krishna embarrassed him, or he embarrassed himself, you could say, and Krishna reinstated him. So that's our faith. Our faith is that as long as I'm serving Krishna and following Krishna, even when I mess up, he'll fix me in a way that's kind and gentle. You could say having him get murdered wasn't kind and gentle, but he had to get murdered. He prescribed murder for somebody. That was the equal and opposite reaction. But it was done in such a... Okay, all right, you got to get murdered. We'll have it happen then.
Because it's just, as you say, it just seems the nature of the material world that will forever be
made in this sense. I don't know if you know Adi Purusha Prabhu. He's one of the main... Shastra preachers in the world, one of the few preachers at the Bhaktivedanta level of Bhagavatam. And he says, you know, this desire that I'm going to manifest all good qualities and I'm never going to make a mistake is a desire for liberation. Which Raghunatha Goswami compares to a... Anybody remember the metaphor? Donkey earring was inner mental deceit. He compares it to a tigress who eats yourself. So, you know, why do I want to have all good qualities and never make a mistake? If I want it so I'll be liberated and I won't have to suffer, it's a problem. If I want to be like that for the pleasure of the Lord, then that's bhakti. Then that feeling of, you know, I can never come to the mark, and I want to act properly, I really want to, but I know I'm going to make mistakes. I know I'm going to mess up. And I'm really sorry, Krishna, that I didn't deal with this customer or co-worker properly. You know, please don't fire me as one of the unfriendly staff. You know, and we just go to Krishna. It's like, I messed up, Krishna. Can I stay? Even though I'm one of the unfriendly staff? And then to be willing to do the things Jamadagni told Parasaram to do. To forgive and do atonement. When I mess up, forgive and atone. That's it. My happiness is that Krishna loves me and I'm trying to love Krishna, not that I'm going to be perfect. Did you want to say something?
I had a question about being in the position of a preacher where we need to look for people with compassion and treat them equally, but at the same time, that responsibility to distinguish between who is given to a preacher.
That's right.
In my name on the card. So how come at the same time we need to be equal poised and treat everyone equally, but only Madhya can actually distinguish who's good or bad?
Yeah, this is the conundrum. We are enjoined that we have to make distinctions. We have to make distinctions for our own association. Even the Uttam Adhikari, who sees only good in everybody, distinguishes for their own personal association. They do. Gorkhasura Das Babaji certainly did. You know, I mean, we have Jagannath Das Babaji, who was happy to feed the dogs of the Dham in that way. So I see we see everyone equally in the sense that we see that everyone is a soul and everyone is ultimately looking for Krishna. And even terrible, sinful things that someone does is a misguided attempt to look for Krishna. That we don't ever condemn anybody, and we don't ever think we're better than anybody. Because my experience is, every time I think I'm better than somebody, Krishna shows me that I'm not. I remember once hearing about a severe mistake done by a devotee, and I was feeling very condemning. How could this person do such a thing? Then I had a dream that I did something like that. And I woke up and I said, thank you, Krishna, for embarrassing me in a dream and not in my waking life. But I really took it that Krishna was saying, don't criticize. Who are you? I really felt like he was saying that. Like Krishna was saying, the only reason you haven't done that particular thing is I've protected you. It's not that there's no tendency in you for that. Don't criticize. So we're told, you know, over and over and over again in the Shastra, by Bhakti Santa, by Srila Prabhupada, by all of our acharyas, don't criticize. Now, of course, again, when you're in authority, you have to criticize, but it should be a loving, out of loving friendship and not out of ego. But although you don't criticize others, you're not a fool. And some people you may have to say, sorry, you can't come to the temple. You know, what do you do? You have to do that. You have to restrict the entry of, you know, a lot of our temples have a sign up. The management reserves the right of entry. Going to have somebody come in here who's going to shoot people or burn down the building. We might see, you know, your desire to shoot people and burn down the building. What you're really looking for are the pastimes of Nrisingadeva and Parasaram. You're just looking for it in the wrong way. But they're looking for it in the wrong way, and so you can't come here. Sorry. I hope someday you find it in the right way. Does that make sense? You know, but. To never, even someone you're guiding, never think, I am better. You know, you may see, okay, this person, it's a practical thing. All right, I'm preaching to this person, and what level of Krishna consciousness should I present to this person? You may have the capacity of presenting a much higher level than you present to them. It's an offense to present Krishna consciousness to a level higher than a person can digest, yes? To preach the glories of the name to the faithless, that's an offense. So we have to be very careful. You know, if someone's qualified enough to talk about Krishna's pastimes with the gopis, that doesn't mean they do that in an intricate way to the public. So they're discriminating. Now here's someone who's at my same level and I can speak to them about, you know, the most intimate, elevated things in my heart. Here's somebody who's not quite at that level, so I can speak to them about these topics. Here's somebody who's just beginning Krishna consciousness, and I have to speak to them in a more general way. You know, that's... But you're not condemning. You're not saying this person who's just beginning Krishna consciousness, well, they're just a low newbie and I'm an elevated devotee. In fact, if you're really an elevated devotee, you think you're lower than that person. You think, at least this person's coming and looking for Krishna, whereas me, I've been around so long and I'm still just absorbed in my ego. Is that okay? It's those... If we use the necessary, we must discriminate. If we use that as an excuse to be egoistic and condemning, then we've just immediately put ourselves actually down at the lowest possible level of devotee. The materialistic devotee who thinks they're better than everybody else. And that kind of thing. And then, frankly, we're not qualified to be in any position of training or guiding anybody. All right? Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Bhagavatam ki jai, Parasaram ki jai, Jamadagni ki jai.